From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
We should be free to live, free from sectarian harassment, free to choose our place of residence, and have freedom to walk the town in safety.
As the British Prime Minister and Irish Premier meet in London, we'll speak with a mother and activist from Northern Ireland. Also, 78 students are arrested as they fight to save ethnic studies at UC Berkeley. And a conversation about B-52s and Apaches in the sixth week of the bombing of Yugoslavia. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Yesterday, Indonesia and Portugal signed a landmark agreement that will perhaps allow the people of East Timor to decide whether they will have independence. I was at the United Nations late yesterday when the agreement was signed and filed this report.
The ballot, which is slated to take place August 8th, will allow Timorese to cast a yes or no vote on autonomy, not to be confused with independence. If the Timorese reject autonomy, Indonesia says it will grant East Timor independence. The key question is whether people can vote in an atmosphere free of fear. In the last month, there have been several massacres conducted by Indonesian armed Timorese militias. According to today's agreement, the Indonesian military will in fact be responsible for security. To many Timorese and their supporters, the Indonesian military and security are a contradiction in terms. Since Indonesia invaded East Timor in 1975, the military has killed more than a third of the population. Now, in the last months, violence has escalated with the establishment of Timorese paramilitaries. While the Portuguese Foreign Minister, Jaime Gama, who signed the accord, says that today's accord now holds the military responsible. And if Indonesia's violence continues, the UN Secretary General, armed with the agreement, can take the issue to the Security Council. Meanwhile, in Washington, two U.S. senators, Russell Feingold of Wisconsin and Patrick Leahy of Vermont, as well as Congressmember Patrick Kennedy of Rhode Island, have announced they are introducing bills to cut off all military aid, arms sales, and training to Indonesia until the successful conclusion of the August 8th vote. I'm Amy Goodman at the United Nations.
That report filed last night from the United Nations as the foreign ministers of Indonesia, Ali Alatas, long a supporter of the Indonesian occupation of East Timor, and the foreign minister of Portugal, Jaime Gama, signed off on the accord with the United Nations Secretary General, Kofi Annan. This news from Germany: high-level talks set for today will aim to narrow the rift between the West and Russia over Kosovo, but the bombing of Yugoslavia is set to intensify. NATO bombed an industrial site and fuel tanks in the southern Serbian city of Niš late Wednesday, the 43rd night of air raids, this according to the Serbian media. Air raid sirens sounded in Belgrade. Diplomats dampened hopes there would be any breakthrough that might bring a swift end to the conflict when seven Western foreign ministers and their Russian counterpart meet near Bonn today. Ringing in their ears will be a warning by President Clinton that far from a diplomatic solution being imminent, the bombing is about to be stepped up. Clinton said yesterday, "We will continue to pursue this campaign in which we are now engaged. We will intensify it in an unrelenting way until these objectives are met." The NATO allies now believe they will need nearly twice the 28,000 peacekeeping troops they originally planned to station in Kosovo in a negotiated settlement, this according to Allied and American officials. American and other NATO officials said the alliance would need perhaps as many as 50,000 soldiers to enforce any Kosovo settlement, even if NATO bombing eventually forced President Slobodan Milosevic of Yugoslavia to accept Allied demands to stop attacking ethnic Albanians and civilians in the province, withdraw Serbian forces, and let the refugees and peacekeepers enter unopposed. Under NATO's original plan, the United States would have contributed 4,000 soldiers to a peacekeeping force, but that number is likely to grow substantially. The U.S. closed its anti-drug trafficking mission in Panama yesterday in a move that officials admitted would reduce the effectiveness of the drug fight in Latin America and the Caribbean. Members of the U.S. Congress criticized Bill Clinton's administration for not doing more to try to forestall the closure of the Howard Air Force Base in Panama, which is shutting in accordance with treaties signed between the two countries in 1977. In Panama, U.S. officials expressed fears the country's importance as a transit route for drug shipments would increase as traffickers took advantage of the U.S. exit. The U.S. has had a military presence in Panama for most of the century, associated with its continuing control of the Panama Canal. But the 1977 treaties that hand the canal over to Panama this year also require the withdrawal of all U.S. forces. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. High-level talks today in Bonn over the war in Yugoslavia will aim to narrow the rift between the West and Russia over Kosovo. But the NATO bombings in the Balkans are set to intensify. On the 43rd night of NATO airstrikes in Yugoslavia, a missile attack last night on fuel dumps in the southern city of Nis caused five massive fires, which rage well into today. As foreign ministers from the West and Russia met today in Bonn, President Clinton said he would welcome Russian participation in an international force to be sent to Yugoslavia after the conflict, but said it must have NATO at its core. Today, we're going to take a look at the weapons in the war against Yugoslavia. Yesterday's fiery crash of a second U.S. Apache helicopter in Albania, which killed its two pilots, has raised questions about whether the craft should be used in Yugoslavia. The helicopters are able to destroy tanks and are used on low-altitude attacks against Serb forces. Meanwhile, NATO said yesterday it will send 24 F-18 fighter bombers at an air base in southern Hungary to use on air raids against Yugoslavia, the first NATO attack planes to be based in a NATO country bordering Yugoslavia. We're joined right now by John Pike, who is a defense analyst for the Federation of American Scientists based in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!, John Pike. Well, let's first talk about the long-awaited, at least in terms of the military and what it promised, Apache helicopters. First one went down the first day they were in action, hit a tree. That didn't kill anyone. The second one went down this week and killed the two pilots.
And disappointing and tragic. I don't think that anybody should be surprised by it.
We're talking to John Pike, who is with the Federation of American Scientists. The Apaches that went down, $20 million per Apache helicopter. Can you talk about the origins of the Apache?
Well, the Apache, in some sense, goes back to the Key West Agreement that the Army and the Air Force signed over half a century ago, in which the Air Force was given responsibility for fixed-wing aircraft and the regular airplanes, and the Army was basically left with helicopters. Now, the problem was that the Army needed some sort of air power to provide direct support for its troops, and since it couldn't use fixed-wing aircraft like the tank-killing A-10 Warthog, which is an Air Force plane, they had to develop their own attack aircraft, helicopters, such as the Apache. They originally used a small attack helicopter in the Vietnam War, the Cobra, which was retired from service a few months ago. And in the 1970s, they finally started developing a much larger attack helicopter, the Apache, of which there are over 800 currently in service.
John Pike with us from the Federation of American Scientists. What do you think $20 million can buy other than an Apache helicopter? I mean, I think there are a lot of people now, $40 million. Some might say, well, maybe that'll save lives. It'll be some fewer bombs that are dropped over Yugoslavia. But you think about a trade-off every time a weapon is built, every time a weapon is sent to Yugoslavia.
Well, I think that, unfortunately, that's one of the problems that we've had in our national decision-making with the end of the Cold War, that we really haven't been presented with precisely the guns and butter sorts of trade-offs that presidents, beginning particularly with President Eisenhower, cautioned that we needed to be making. Under the rules, the budget rules that the Congress has been operating under, the defense budget is voted on entirely separately from the rest of the budget for other national priorities. And consequently, it's been very easy for the Congress to buy a lot of weapons that we don't need while not funding a lot of other urgent national priorities. And I'm afraid that in the current budget environment where the Congress is getting ready to double the president's emergency request for funding for prosecution of the war with a lot of pork barrel projects and corporate goodies, that we still seem to be very far away from being able to have a serious national debate about where our priorities are.
Who makes the Apache?
The Apache is made by Boeing, which acquired McDonnell Douglas, which was the original manufacturer. Boeing also makes a variety of other combat aircraft. And actually, we're sort of to the point right now with all of the defense mergers that anything that's not made by Boeing is probably made by Lockheed Martin, which is the other defense contractor. I think this has been one of the growing problems in getting rational priorities for our defense establishment and for the national budget generally, is that increasingly you have a very small number of very influential defense contractors who have perfected the art of transforming thousands of dollars in campaign contributions into billions of dollars in contracts for weapon systems, which I think goes a long way towards explaining why it is the Congress is going to be adding so much to the defense budget this year and why it is we continue to buy so many weapon systems that we really don't need.
Is it true, do the Apache helicopters fire depleted uranium bullets? I was talking to an Army spokesperson from the Pentagon, and he said they come from the A-10 Warthogs and Apache.
Well, the A-10 Warthog certainly fires a 30-millimeter shell that's an armor-piercing bullet that does contain depleted uranium. I've heard different accounts about whether or not the Apache fires a depleted uranium shell. If it does, thus far I haven't been able to identify that piece of ammunition. It's certainly the case, though, that the Warthog has been used in action firing the gun that does fire that depleted uranium bullet, and that was confirmed as recently as this Monday by General Wald, who gives the military briefing every day over at the Pentagon.
Actually, tomorrow we're going to talk extensively about depleted uranium and its use from Iraq to Yugoslavia. But today, moving on from Apache to the use of B-52s, can you talk about the B-52, what role it's played in history, and what role it's playing in Yugoslavia?
Well, at the outset of Operation Allied Force, the current air campaign, the takeoff of B-52 bombers from RAF Fairford, a base in Britain, was really the first signal that the war was starting, since they took off about 8 hours before the shooting started over Yugoslavia. They initially went into combat firing conventional air-launched cruise missiles that were fired against heavily defended air defense sites. More recently, they've doubled the numbers of B-52s, and the night before last, they were used dropping non-precision gravity bombs against fielded forces down in Kosovo. This is, of course, highly reminiscent to the use of B-52s in the Vietnam War. There have been significant improvements in the accuracy of the B-52 navigation system and, frankly, the improvements in just about everything else in the B-52. So it's considerably more precise in its effects, even using these dumb bombs, than it was, say, three decades ago. Nonetheless, it's an extremely destructive weapon. and has undoubtedly inflicted significant casualties on Yugoslav forces,
many
of whom, frankly, are draftees who had no desire to be any part of this war.
More precise doesn't mean precise.
Well, one of the problems that they have had in prosecuting the air campaign is that they have clearly been attempting to avoid killing innocent civilians. Now, this is a real war being fought with real weapons, and it's impossible to completely eliminate that, as much as some people might want to think that this is simply a video game. In using the B-52s, they have restricted themselves to attacking Yugoslav forces that have been dug in around the periphery of Kosovo. They've only used them, I believe, against those military forces that are fairly far away from civilian populations. Unavoidably, however, even the most precise munitions sometimes stray off target, and even with the best intelligence, sometimes you wind up attacking the wrong target. NATO forces have clearly killed dozens, if not hundreds, of innocent civilians in this war, and as the war continues, I think that that death toll unavoidably is going to mount.
Again, John Pike is our guest. He is a research scientist with the Federation of American Scientists in Washington, D.C. What about Russia right now? The Washington Post reported on Friday that Boris Yeltsin has approved a blueprint for the development and use of non-strategic nuclear weapons. Several experts say the decision may jeopardize the future of the Bush-Gorbachev tactical nuclear agreement, which called for the mutual withdrawal of large numbers of these weapons.
Well, this is obviously a matter of considerable concern. The conventional air-launched cruise missiles that the B-52s were firing have been converted from nuclear-tipped cruise missiles, as have all of the sea-launched Tomahawk cruise missiles that the Navy's been firing. Initially, those missiles were equipped with nuclear warheads, and those warheads were taken off those missiles under the agreement that you mentioned between President Bush and President Gorbachev. I think that the problem that the Russians face is that with the loss of their Soviet empire, with the difficulties they're having in maintaining their conventional forces, with their apprehensions about the United States throwing its weight around as the sole remaining superpower, they see nuclear weapons as being pretty much their sole remaining claim to fame. And it looks like, number one, they may be going back on this informal agreement to take tactical nuclear weapons out of the field, and it's clearly the case that they have yet to ratify the START II arms reduction agreement, and the domestic reaction in Russia to the war against Serbia has clearly set back that ratification process. With the end of the Cold War, I think that there was a lot of hope that we would be able to quickly reverse the nuclear arms race and achieve dramatic cuts in the number of nuclear weapons that are deployed. That clearly has not happened. And over the last several years, indeed, it looks like we're starting to go back in the other direction. India and Pakistan testing nuclear weapons, Russia not ratifying arms control agreements, and now perhaps reintroducing nuclear weapons that had previously been withdrawn from service.
You are listening to John Pike as we wrap up this discussion right now. Final question, John Pike, and it's about casualties. Very difficult to get the number of people who've been killed in Yugoslavia. The Yugoslavian government is claiming over 1,200 civilians have been killed and 5,000 wounded. But papers here in the United States are talking something like 150 or perhaps 200. How do these numbers get determined?
Frankly, in the real world, many times they don't get determined. When you go look in the history books, you'll be able to find some fairly precise numbers that people attribute to how many people have been killed in previous wars. It doesn't take very much investigation to determine that frequently you never know how many people have been killed in a war. I think that it is clear that many dozens, if not hundreds, of civilians have been killed. It's equally probable that many hundreds, if not several thousand, Yugoslav military personnel have been killed. I'm not sure that we're ever going to know the final death toll, but clearly thousands of Kosovars and Serbs were killed in Kosovo last year. Thousands have been killed in Kosovo this year, and many, many hundreds, if not thousands, have been killed as a result of the NATO air campaign. It's an unavoidable fact that war is terrible, which is why I think Russia, the NATO governments have been trying to get a diplomatic solution to this as soon as possible.
John Pike is the defense analyst for the Federation of American Scientists, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to Northern Ireland. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. In an ongoing effort to break the political stalemate over decommissioning arms in Northern Ireland, the British Prime Minister Tony Blair and Irish Premier Bertie Ahern are meeting today with key party leaders in Downing Street. Blair and Ahern are chairing a series of negotiations between the three major political parties of Northern Ireland, Sinn Féin, headed by Gerry Adams, the Ulster Unionists, led by David Tremble, and the SDPL, headed by John Hume. Officials on both sides say they're not hopeful the talks will deliver any breakthroughs in the dispute over the issue of paramilitary weapons. Unionist politicians refuse to sit with Sinn Féin in government unless the Irish Republican Army begins to dispose of its weapons. However, Republicans say they can't deliver any IRA gesture on arms. Adams told a London-based Irish Post newspaper yesterday he could, quote, understand why armed groups who do not consider themselves to have been defeated, who in the past have been accused of leaving communities defenseless, are in the position they're in. Today, we're going to take a look at the most controversial road in Northern Ireland. It's called Garvaghy Road. The road has made headlines around the world because almost every year, members of the Unionist Orange Order march through it in an act of intimidation against the community's Catholic residents. Well, a few days ago, I had a chance to speak with Orla Maloney, resident of Garvaghy Road, a close friend of the human rights lawyer Rosemary Nelson, who was assassinated this past March. Orla worked with Rosemary on the Residents' Council of Garvaghy Road, which met last January with Blair and Ahern asking for protection. In particular, Rosemary Nelson asked for protection. She'd received numerous death threats, and Nelson never got that protection, killed by a car bomb outside her home on March 15th. I started off by asking Orla Maloney if she can just describe Garvaghy Road.
Well, Portadown is the town where the Orange Order was founded over 200 years ago. And Garvaghy Road encompasses several estates. It's a road about a mile long, and almost 7,000 people live there. A nationalist community concentrated on this one-mile stretch of road on the west of Portadown.
Let's even go to some more basics. You talk about it's where the Orange Order was founded, and you talk about nationalists.
Yes.
Can you explain who are nationalists and what is the Orange Order?
Well, nationalists are made up mainly of Catholics who support a united Ireland. The Orange Order is a sectarian organisation which was founded in 1795. And, I mean, amongst their rules are that they cannot go into a Catholic church or have anything to do with Catholics. It's a complete sectarian organisation dedicated to upholding the Orange State, the union with Great Britain. And during the early 70s, the town was mixed. The estates around the town were mixed. It's a town of almost 30,000. But during the early 70s, people, nationalists, were bombed, shot, burnt, and threatened and intimidated out of their homes around the town, and hence became concentrated on the Garvaghy Road. New houses were being built there at the time. We have to cross the town for any services like third level education, The health center, dentists, library, swimming pool, anything we need, we have to cross the town. Now, in a 300-yard stretch of the main street of the town, 10 people have been killed in recent years. Nationalists are subject to all kinds of attacks, sectarian attacks, verbal abuse and physical abuse in the middle of town.
By who? Who's attacking them?
By loyalist youths. These are people loyal to the crown. And we compare them to Ku Klux Klan types. Their whole ethos is supremacy. My first experience of an Orange March, I'm a Dubliner and I moved there in 1972 to Portadown. I married a Portadown man. And my first experience of an Orange March was the banner leading it saying Protestant supremacy. And basically that's what...
You mean the banner that was at the head of the march?
Yes.
Saying...
Yes, Protestant supremacy. And that is basically the problem. The Orange Order would maintain that they want religious liberty to go to their place of worship and return wherever they like. And we do not want a sectarian, racist, supremacist march coming through our area. Now, our children have no opportunity to meet the other religion because of the segregation of the town. And I would feel that this march was bad for community relations. If my children's only experience of the other religion is to see them come through our area with banners celebrating the victory of Protestants over Catholics in battles in 1690, with racist tunes. For instance, one of their songs would be, "We want to be up to our neck in Fenian blood."
In what blood?
Fenian blood. Fenians being Catholics. This is the ethos of the Orange Order.
Now, explain what the tradition is. What is the date that the Orange Order marches every year?
Well, it's the first Sunday in July, the Sunday before the 12th of July, the 12th of July being the date when they celebrate the victory of King William over King James, and that's where the religious thing comes in.
We're now in May, just about 2 months away. Is there organizing that's going on right now on Garvahi Road leading up to that?
Last year, the Parades Commission ruled that the march should not come down and we should be given a breathing space. The Orange Men refused to accept this ruling and gathered in their thousands on the first Sunday in July. And what diffused their protest was the burning of three children. Three children were burned alive in their beds. The vast majority of them went home. But a large section stayed out at Drumcree Church, and we have been subjected to nightly harassment since that.
Explain what happened to the kids last year.
Well, there was trouble throughout the north of Ireland. Hijackings, burnings, bombings, attacks by the Orange, the Loyalists on the security forces, and sectarian attacks. One of those was an attack where three children were burnt alive in their beds. Now, this diffused the situation to an extent. And they have had almost 200 illegal protests and demonstrations since that. We have this mile-long road, the Garvahi Road, and there are three interface areas where it faces into the Loyalist community. And they gather here on the corners at night. For instance, in September, they killed a policeman, Constable Frankie O'Reilly, on one of the interface areas. I was present when he was fatally injured. And as the ambulance came to take him away, their women were chanting and cheering and clapping in glee at his demise.
What happened to him?
A blast bomb.
A what bomb?
A blast bomb. This is the kind of thing our children are living with. You've got the noise of the helicopter circling overhead, and the children are waiting and wondering at night to see what kind of incursion there is. And they gather at the corner. Sometimes it takes the police up to an hour to come, what should take them 60 seconds, a trip to the interface. Several families have been intimidated out of their homes at the interface area since last September. While Bill Clinton was visiting us, four of the 10 Catholic businesses in town were burnt out. last September. The media has paid very little attention to this conduct. And we feel that if it was happening in London to a black community, or here in the United States to a black community, there would be outrage. I was talking to somebody recently who had lived through the Second World War and said it must feel like the Jews felt going into their ghetto at night, were ghettoized and corralled in this small area on the west of the town. We can't go out at night. If we do, we would have to check by phone at what area are the demonstrations and protests, because they come with iron bars, baseball bats, blast bombs, catapults and ball bearings. And we've had numerous injuries.
Orla Maloney, what is it like for your children? How many do you have?
I have 7 children.
Ranging in age from?
From 25 down to 10. Mm-hmm. Now, the oldest 4 are away at university. And 2 of them say they will use their degrees to come back into their own community. One daughter has gone to Scotland. She's a little boy of 4. She's afraid to bring him home. She says, why would I bring him up in this? I have 3 children left at home. My husband is constantly checking where they are. I have a 10-year-old who didn't go to school for 5 weeks before Christmas. A 10-year-old suffering from deep depression. And we went to Mayo to visit my mother on New Year's Day. We just got one day away because we can't have holidays. We can't do anything normal. And when we came back, she broke down crying, and I sat up all night with her to see what was wrong. And she said, I've no hope, Mummy. Christmas is over. Her older 4 brothers and sisters were gone away. She said, they won't come back because of this town and this road. She said, we were in Ackle for New Year's Day, where everybody was happy. We could give out presents and enjoy ourselves. And now we're back to this. And we had bought them new bunk beds for Christmas. And she told me she stood on the top bunk and considered throwing herself off the bunk. She has no hope. And she says, I knew it wouldn't kill me and I'd only be more trouble to you. You know, we don't have help for our children. The health of the people has suffered. Our doctors could tell you about the increase in the consumption of sleeping tablets, antidepressants, nervous breakdowns, heart attacks.
Why don't you move?
I'm coming at this from a spiritual perspective, and I feel if something is wrong, that one must find the courage to face it. And if sectarianism or racism or a desire to dominate or look down on people is wrong, that you have to stand and expose it and face it and try to deal with it. And that's why I stay. It's our town. We can't run away from the problem. That isn't right.
I saw you speak at a conference over the weekend around oppressed communities from Cape Town to Northern Ireland to New York to California, making linkages. And you opened, though, because the conference was dedicated to Rosemary Nelson, who is the woman from Northern Ireland, the human rights attorney who was blown up in a car bomb recently. And you talked about her and your friendship with her. Could you just briefly tell us about Rosemary Nelson and what she fought for? In fact, as you were saying, you felt it was important to stand up. I was thinking about Rosemary Nelson.
Well, that's what Rosemary was about. She was an example to all of us. She worked for people that had nobody else to work for them. And she worked right across the board for all sections of the community. She wasn't interested in making money as a lawyer. She was interested in being a voice for people that had no voice. She was totally unselfish. She gave herself to us all hours of the day and night. She was our legal advisor. She was our friend. And when my 10-year-old daughter was asked at school to write an essay about somebody whom she would choose as a role model, she chose Rosemary. And when she was crying the night before I came over here, she didn't want me to go away. And I told her I was coming to talk about Rosemary. She then stopped crying and wrote a little poem about Rosemary and her courage and the brutality of her killing. And I can only say that it was an honor and a privilege to know Rosemary Nelson. And that's the legacy I would like to leave to my children. That you stand up, no matter how small a community you are and how big the other community is. That you stand up against what is wrong.
One of the cases that Rosemary Nelson represented was a young man who was kicked to death in front of the British soldiers who were supposedly protecting the area.
Yes, Robert Hamill was kicked to death by a gang of loyalists.
When was this?
This was 2 years ago. Right in the middle, the centre of the town, on his way home. He and his cousins were walking home. I was at that social event that night. I had left earlier in a taxi. I had a real bad feeling that night. That's why I left early. He was 15 yards from an RUC Land Rover. That's the police Land Rover. And they watched as 30 youths kicked him to death. And as he lay there waiting for an ambulance, they made no attempt to resuscitate him. And that's the situation that we're living in. We have nobody to defend us.
Do you have a boy at home?
I do. I have a 19-year-old, a 13-year-old. And two of my sons are away. One's in Dublin, one's in Manchester.
How are your boys at home dealing with this?
It's extremely difficult to teach your children to love their neighbour as themselves and that all people are equal when they see that we are not treated as equals. That our local MP, David Trimble, has not seen fit to talk to somebody like me.
Can you talk about, for yourself, you know, the psychological effect that this has had? For example, smoking. You and Rosemary Nelson were chain smokers. You are a chain smoker.
We're chain.
She was?
She was. I was going to say she is. I can't come to terms with her death. The day we visited Tony Blair, she and I talked about this. All of the women chain smoke. Everybody does. And we kind of joked about, you know, why should we worry about smoking when our lives were under threat like this? My own doctor, who's an anti-smoking fanatic, told me the last time I saw him, Orla, don't worry about smoking anymore. You know, I know what you're living with. That says it all.
You went with Rosemary Nelson to see Tony Blair?
Yes.
And what did you talk about with him?
We talked about the situation that we're living with, the nightly incursions, the harassment, the health of our children, and asked once again for the implementation of the equality agenda of the agreement.
And the equality agenda says what?
That we should be free to live, free from sectarian harassment, free to choose our place of residence, and have freedom to walk the town in safety.
How many of you went to see him?
Five of us, four from the Residents Coalition and Rosemary as our legal advisor.
When did you see him?
I think it was the 18th of January.
1999?
Yes. We met him again the end of March in Stormont, himself and Bertie Ahern. That day Bertie Ahern said he'd be in touch in a day or two. I haven't heard from him yet. I mean, one of the issues for us is security. The two councillors have security as councillors. I have no security as an ordinary mother living in a very vulnerable position. And when the British government haven't seen fit to offer the coalition members security, we've asked the Irish government and we don't have any word back from them. And like, I'm appealing to Bertie Ahern as a Dubliner, I think that he should be seeing to my safety.
Did Rosemary Nelson ask Tony Blair, the British Prime Minister, for security?
We had brought it up several times. We had brought it up at the talks in July with Jonathan Powell, who's Tony Blair's right-hand man. He's his chief of staff. And at every meeting, we brought up the issue of security. We brought it up with Tony Blair and Bertie Ahern the end of March again. This has been brought to their attention on a consistent basis. I mean, they gave us an armed guard back into our area in July because, you know, when we left Jonathan Powell in Armagh, the 11-mile trip was made with the British Army seeing us back into our area. So they knew then.
And Rosemary Nelson had gotten death threats before.
Yes.
Why didn't they provide security?
I don't know that. We've all had death threats. I don't know why they won't provide security.
You've had death threats?
Yes.
How do they come to you?
I've had them by phone. Rosemary had them directly, related to her clients directly from the OUC. Where we all get phone calls, letters, bullets in the post, things like that.
Royal Ulster Constabulary is the RUC. In fact, didn't even a British report just come out talking about its collusion with the paramilitaries?
Yes, that's under investigation. And what we've been demanding is a full, independent investigation and inquiry into her murder.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We've been speaking with Orla Maloney, who is with the Residents Coalition of Gravahi Road, a member of the Faith and Justice group of her area, and a mother trying to lead a normal life in Northern Ireland. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. In an ongoing story that we are covering, police at the University of California, Berkeley, arrested 81 people Tuesday on the sixth day of a student protest called to push for more money for ethnic studies programs. The students had set up a tent city in front of California Hall, which houses the offices of Chancellor Robert Berdahl. Some students who refused to leave were dragged away. About 100 activists, including six on a hunger strike, took part in the protest that started a week ago today. A student coalition called the Third World Liberation Front argues that with a $300,000 budget cut, the elimination of eight important courses, only one Chicano studies professor and a half a professorship for Native American studies, the university is destroying the ethnic studies department. The group has presented the chancellor with a list of seven demands concerning faculty hiring, funding, and other issues. It's worth mentioning that 30 years ago, in 1969, the first ethnic studies department in the country came to Berkeley after student protesters shut down the campus. Well, today's protesters note that people such as Ward Connerly, who's a member of the UC Board of Regents, want to eliminate academic programs of diversity altogether, a move which could lead to the elimination of women's studies, gay and lesbian studies, ethnic dorms, and a host of other university programs and services. We're joined now by two of the people involved in the protests. Professor Carlos Munoz is a professor of ethnic studies at UC Berkeley and author of Youth Identity Power, the Chicano Movement. Also, Amy Sadao is with us. She's a first-year graduate student in ethnic studies and a member of the Third World Liberation Front, the student group organizing the protest to save ethnic studies. Amy, let's begin with you. Can you tell us what the scene was this week at UC Berkeley?
As you know, the tent city was raided by the police early on Tuesday morning, while 78 of our supporters were jailed. The remaining people were able to rally together, one of the largest student groups we've seen on campus since the anti-apartheid movement. Over 500 people came out in support of our campaign to defend ethnic studies. And about 300 of them remained that evening at our site out front in California Hall, reestablishing our space. The hunger strikers were released and came back to camp and joined us there, and around 300 students set up camp and stayed overnight there. The police did not bother us at that time, but this last night, with the added understanding that we have actually gained a place at the negotiating table with Chancellor Berdahl, being set for Friday in the morning, and our coalition being scheduled for a press conference today at noon to release the new joint student-faculty proposal, which we'd like to take to the table on Friday. We also understood that 10 of our faculty members were willing to come to the campsite and stay there, or come to the campsite and risk arrests in hope that the chancellor would remain in good faith until Friday when we could get to the negotiating table.
And the news conference you're holding today, can you explain what you'll be announcing?
Basically, we'll be revealing the joint student-faculty proposal that we would like to take to the table on Friday.
And that is?
In a large part, it focuses on two specific things. One is solidarity between the four departments of the ethnic studies, being comparative ethnic studies, Asian American studies, Chicano, Latino studies, and Native American studies. We are particularly concerned with the lack of faculty in the Native American studies department and the lack of commitment from the university to maintaining the program in Native American studies. And we feel that the nature of the comparative ethnic studies is most important. In addition, we are looking at a proposal that is going to have vision. We're concerned not only with the integrity and autonomy of the Department of Ethnic Studies, but with its future, not only for our children, but for our children's children.
Professor Carlos Munoz, talk about your involvement and the professor's involvement and what it is that you teach, what ethnic studies is.
Well, that's a good question, because I think the public as a whole doesn't really have an understanding, especially given the type of propaganda that has been in this nation, since the beginning of what I call the right-wing counter-revolution against the 1960s that resulted in the Indian affirmative action in California. And now the effort is connected to that to end ethnic studies in any kind of diversity programs in the university. I think that, number one, ethnic studies, is a creation of my generation of the 60s, because at that time, when we were the handful of students of color on the campuses, we were an invisible people. People did not know that indeed people of color existed in the society. And so we demanded 30 years ago, for example, at Berkeley, the establishment of a third world college, because we thought that would be the only way that we could develop a curriculum that would offer the opportunity for not only our own students of color, but also all students, including white students, to come to the process of learning about the multiracial, multicultural realities in our nation. And so the Third World Liberation Front that we organized 30 years ago, and also, I might add, very importantly, with the mass support of thousands of white students at the time, shut down the university and created the Department of Ethnic Studies. The deal was that eventually, once we established ourselves as a legitimate academic discipline, that we would indeed be given the college status in due time. It's been 30 years, and that hasn't happened. Instead, in the last 30 years, and I can tell you for a fact, since I have been teaching for the last 30 years, I am a founding faculty member of Ethnic Studies in the nation as a whole, we have had to struggle every single year for a budget that contributes toward the development of ethnic studies at Berkeley. In spite of the obstacles that have been placed in our path, we have, over time, established ourselves not only as a legitimate academic discipline, thanks to the collective scholarship of African American, Chicano, Latino, Asian American, and Native American scholarship, that we have been able to not only do that, but we have had a significant impact on traditional disciplines in the academy, not only at Berkeley, but nationwide, that have resulted really in putting race at the centerpiece of discussions and dialogue of racial relations in society, and also culture, and now gender and sexuality. And I think that, by all means, we deserve the support of this institution, and we haven't gotten it. Instead, over the last 30 years, and especially the last 10 years, we have been slowly being choked to death in terms of cutbacks that have resulted as a consequence of colleagues coming to retirement or being denied tenure. Those faculty positions have not been replaced by the administration, and we have been struggling with them over the last 5 years, because this started in 1994 in particular, and we now have seven faculty slots, for example, that have yet to be replaced.
Professor Munoz, can you talk about Ward Connerly's role in all of this, the member of the UC Board of Regents who became famous around the country in his fight against affirmative action, now getting involved with this?
By all means. Ward Connerly, no doubt about it, behind the scenes is contributing to this particular process of what I consider the ethnic cleansing of the university. I think that Mr. Connerly, by virtue of being the lead in the struggle to end affirmative action, you know, on Proposition 209 and so forth, now feels that he has the power as a regent to continue the onslaught that has been led by the right-wing Republicans in this country to do away with diversity, period. And so we are the first targets because he realizes that if it were not for ethnic studies in the first place, there would not be any diversity in the university. And so Mr. Connerly, no doubt about it, although now he's keeping his mouth shut presently, is behind the scenes trying to connect, you know, as much as he can, our existence as a legitimate academic discipline to affirmative action in California and nationwide. I want to say something here, too, that needs to be told to the public at large, and that is to say that even though there has been a symbolic, you might say, rhetoric that has been espoused by the chancellor here and throughout the nation, other chancellors and presidents, that they're committed to diversity in spite of California and Washington and presently in Michigan and Florida, probably, in spite of the ending of affirmative action, that simultaneous to that rhetoric, there has been the concrete effort to undermine diversity by virtue of attacks on ethnic studies and, as was mentioned by you at the beginning of the program, attacks on any kind of program of diversity presently in existence at the universities.
And we are talking to Professor Carlos Munoz, who is a professor of ethnic studies at UC Berkeley, also author of Youth Identity Power, the Chicano Movement, and chair of the nation's first Chicano Studies Department at Cal State Los Angeles. In just a minute, we also want to get the phone number if people around the country want to give a call to find out what comes of the meeting tomorrow or talk about their studies around their struggles around ethnic studies. But we've just been also joined by Laura Flanders, who's a Pacifica producer who spent the last months doing a report on the issue of the crackdown on affirmative action and a component of that, ethnic studies around the country, to give us this national picture of what actually is happening now. Laura, can you talk about that? Laura, are you with us? Well, we'll come back to
Laura is lost. Let me say something here that needs to be said, too, that it is not a struggle confined to Berkeley. There's other campuses, as I'm sure Laura will speak to, that have been engaged in the struggle for the development or the creation even of ethnic studies. Harvard University students, for example, 4 years ago and have been since demanding that that institution create ethnic studies. The University of Brown University and Northwestern and other universities across the nation, students that is, have been very much actively involved in efforts to organize and mobilize and then under the demands for ethnic studies. I think it needs to be said very clearly, and that is this, that ethnic studies today is even more needed than it was 30 years ago when we created it at Berkeley. Because number one, the 21st century around the corner will be a century a reality of multiracial, multicultural, you know, realities that need to be dealt with. And we are to prepare the present crop, the present generation of, you know, young students to meet that 21st century head on with a full critical understanding of those realities and the complexity that is inherent in those realities, to develop as, especially as leaders, with a vision that needs to be there for the development of an authentic multiracial democracy. This is why ethnic studies is so vital and why students all over the country, and especially at Berkeley right now, and six of them right now are putting their lives on the line on the hunger strike to make clear the importance and the significance of ethnic studies in the academy.
Let us end with Amy Sadow, the first-year graduate student in ethnic studies and a member of the Third World Liberation Front, the student group organizing the protest to save ethnic studies. Amy, what are you studying at Berkeley?
My work is in, I'm an independent curator, and my work involves contemporary feminist work, and I'd like to do comparative work between African-American feminist contemporary artists, Chicanas, and Asian Americans. I mean, I feel that this work can is opposed to be doing in an art history program by placing race at the center of my studies. I feel that I have the best opportunity to pursue the scholarship within the ethnic studies department. Beyond that, I really feel that what ethnic studies offers, and one of the principles upon the third world of the original Third World Liberation Front, which the students of this current campaign have adopted, is a sense that ethnic studies also challenges the dichotomy that the institution has set up and it's been ingrained in the institution between scholastic work, intellectual work, and politics. And what we see happening here on the Berkeley campus and what we see happening across the nations in student activism is a sense that we are doing, we are learning here in the institution, we are also using to fight injustices within the institution and outside.
And Professor Carlos Munoz, let me give you the last word, as you are part of this coalition that will be meeting with the chancellor tomorrow.
Yes, I want to say that you know, tomorrow when we meet, we look forward to a meaningful end to this crisis, which, by the way, did you make a slight correction at the beginning? You mentioned it started 6 days ago. It actually started back in April 14th, when more than 100 students took over and occupied a campus building for 10 hours to begin the struggle to support the Department of Ethnic Studies. And since then, there's been over 100 students arrested, and six have been on hunger strike now for the eighth day. And that needs to be said. And I think that when we stop to think about this and to ponder the significance of what's going on at Berkeley to the nation as a whole, that we need to understand, as Amy has said it right now, that this goes beyond a struggle to maintain one academic department on one university campus. It represents really the future of this nation when you come right down to it, because it's to be understood that what needs to be laid out here is this is very connected to the struggle for social justice, the struggle for human rights, not only in this country, but throughout the world.
Professor Munoz, I want to thank you for joining us. We're at the end of the show. A quick phone number, if Amy wants to give that out.
People can contact the Liberation Front at 510-393-9191. You can also send your support by...
That's it. That's all we have time for. 510-393-9191. Thanks for calling. Democracy Now! Produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Bernard White is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!